بات باشید.
Where is the United States going for this 21st century? Where is this dream that my parents had about giving our kids a better life? Where is this dream about an America that can exercise the kind of world leadership that all of us believe is important for the future? Those are questions out there.
And what now, would you do?
Look, I'm
what
a
believer. What would you do?
I believe in American leadership. I really do. I've been at this game over 50 years. And I've seen leadership rise to the occasion and face crisis, whether it was wars, recessions, or whether it's natural disasters. And the reason I believe in it is because when you look at the American people, and when I looked at the men and women in uniform who kind of put their lives on the line for this country, I know that there are values out there in which the strength of America really lies. And I think ultimately it's up to the leadership to recognize that the American people want them to lead, want them to take the risks, want them to be able to assert the kind of leadership.
Okay, but I still don't understand what the president, exercising leadership, could have done with respect to the deadlock in Washington, with gridlock in Washington, A, that he didn't do, other than you suggesting he left the battlefield out of frustration. That's what your indictment of him is, that maybe he had the bully pulpit, he had the executive power, he alone had the chance to make it work, and he got frustrated and quit.
Let me tell you, what I think is going to happen right now, regardless of what happens in this next election, is that I think we're in for the likelihood of another two and a half years of stalemate. And I don't think we
until
can...
Until the next presidential election.
And I don't think we can afford that. And frankly, I don't think this president can afford that. And so what I'm saying is this president, I think, has got to roll up his sleeves. And yes, he's going to have to deal with people he may not like. Yes, he's going to have to fight some battles he may not like to fight. But the reality is that he could, by virtue of getting into the ring, I think establish a legacy that is very important for his presidency.
So he can save his president in terms of whatever concerns he may have or his friends may have about his legacy by getting in the ring.
That's right, getting in the ring. And
but he hasn't been in the ring?
He's been in the ring, but the problem is that he doesn't keep the pressure on the institutions of our democracy to do what they have to do. I mean, look, presidents have faced tough Congresses throughout our history. Bill Clinton faced a tough Congress. But he also understood that in the end, you still have to engage with people. You still have to cut a deal.
But is this about this president's personality, his mindset, his experience? Is the reason that he's different than Bill Clinton,
this president,
and Lyndon Johnson?
This president is extremely bright, extremely able, extremely interested in doing the right thing
for
the
country. But you just said he's not in the fight.
But the problem is, if you want to be able to get things done in Washington, you have got to fight for it. You have got to fight for it every day. Look, when we had passed a budget by Bill Clinton, the Democrats or the Republicans took a walk. So we had to pass it on the Democratic side. We established a war room. We went after every vote. We had to work every vote. And ultimately, we were able to win it by one vote in the House, one vote, and one vote in the Senate, the vice president's vote. That was because of a tough fight to get it done. That's the kind of dedication to how we should push our democracy.
Okay, but you haven't told me why Bill Clinton is that way and Barack Obama's not that way.
Because, Bill Clinton, the one thing that's different between the two of them is Bill Clinton loves politics, loves the engagement, loves to cut a deal. And I think Barack Obama, as a law professor, wants the logic of his position to basically persuade people. And in Washington, logic isn't enough. You've got to be able to go in and be able to push people in the right direction.
Exercise power.
You've got to do that. I mean,
Abraham
Lincoln, in the 13th Amendment, had to basically go to the Congress, and he had to buy some votes. He had to go after those votes in order to pass the 13th Amendment.
So, but where were you when Bill Clinton, when the president wasn't doing this? Were you whispering in his ear? Were you telling him in a meeting, Mr. President, I've been around this town for a long time. I've been in the Congress.
Let me give you the best example.
Head of OMB.
There was some crazy thing called sequester. And sequester was this crazy mechanism that Congress developed to basically shoot themselves in the head. They put a gun to their head and they said, if we don't do the right thing, we'll pull the trigger. So they don't do the right thing. And suddenly this drastic cut is going to go into effect. And I went to the president and I went to the leadership of the Congress and I said, look, this is going to damage the country. It's going to hurt our defense. It's going to hurt our readiness. It's going to basically hollow out our capability. And it's going to hurt domestic programs that are important to people. They said, you're right. This is terrible. And I said, okay, so what do we do about this?
Both sides said, Republican leadership in Congress.
But absolutely.
The president said, you're right.
Both sides said, you're right. This is going to hurt the country. And I said, so I'll tell you what. I'll put another $100 billion in defense savings on the table if that'll help you cut a deal. Nothing happened. Nothing happened. Teddy Roosevelt once said, you know, when you're facing a tough decision, the best thing you can do is to make the right decision. The next best thing you can do is to make the wrong decision. But the worst thing you can do is to do nothing.
Yes. Here's what you wrote. The budget deal that included automatic spending cuts known as sequestration, even though nearly everyone agreed privately that they were bad policy, Panetta says he found himself a lonely figure actively opposing them by lobbying Congress and making speeches warning that the Pentagon cuts would harm national security.
Yeah. Hmm. Yeah, I mean, I've been a member of Congress. I was elected to the Congress, and was served in the Congress for 16 years. When you serve in the Congress, your responsibility, the oath you swear, is to protect this country. And you don't do things that deliberately hurt the country by your failure to act.
What changed?
I think there are a lot of things that are contributing to that. I mean, a lot of people are asking the question, what created the dysfunction that we see today?
Yeah.
And there are a lot of factors, I think, that are involved. Too much money, redistricting that creates safe seats, a media that engages in sound bites as opposed to really looking at people.
You're saying this when we're having a one-hour conversation, by the way.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think there's a lot of emphasis on the conflict rather than people that try to resolve issues. And I think that as a result of all of that, there's a sense of not taking the risks that you have to take in order to govern. And frankly, leadership is all about taking risks. It's about sometimes jeopardizing your own political position in order to do what's right for the country.
Some people say the defense budget today is way too low when you look at the challenge we're facing.
I think what I'm scared about with the defense budget is the uncertainty in Washington with regards to the budget. I mean, right now, instead of developing a budget, they basically kicked the can down the road. They did a continuing resolution into after the election. The likelihood is when they come back, they'll probably do another continuing resolution. And we may be facing again the prospect of, again, going into sequester or going into another shutdown. That instability and uncertainty is really eroding our ability to maintain our national defense the way we should. I would like them to develop a long-term, five-year agreement on the budget that says this is what we're going to do on defense so that we know what needs to be cut, but we know that there is stability in terms of the defense budget for the next 5 years.
So you've talked about President Obama. You talked about President Bush, 43. There is President Clinton. There's also Hillary Clinton.
Yeah.
Tell me about her, not in terms of whether you like or you support her to be president, but in terms of where she stands in all these qualities we've been talking about. But give me some specifics.
Yeah. I dealt an awful lot with her when she was Secretary of State and I was Secretary of Defense and also CIA director. And, I found her to be very strong and steady, believing in the strength of America, believing in the position of the United States in the world and our need to exercise world leadership. I mean, we went to the Arab countries and basically said that they ought to put together a defense system similar to what's going on with this coalition.
Right.
That we ought to put together a defense system to be able to have them work as a group to assist us in dealing with the challenges in the Middle East. And she was there. She was in the room. And I was there, and we were talking to these Arab countries to do exactly that. Wherever I have gone with her, I have always found her to be a strong and reliable friend.
Oh, you're a member in good standing of the Democratic Party?
Yes, indeed.
I read something today said that some people on the left of your party, you know, have apprehension about Secretary Clinton. They said she's too much of a hawk. She's too close to Wall Street. And she, her instincts are too centrist. You agree with that? She's all those things?
Hawkish? I think she
centrist,
is. She's strong.
Close to Wall Street.
She's strong on national security.
She's represented in New York, by the way.
Yeah. No, she's strong on national security. And like her husband, I think she really wants to, in terms of our economy, develop a broad-based economy where Wall Street is not, you know, has to play a role in terms of being able to strengthen our economy. I want the ability of, a president to kind of reach out to this country in many ways, to bring this country together. I think we're too divided right now. I think I think the country is divided
over.
I think we're divided politically. I think we're divided in terms of our views as to, you know, what's the direction.
And our role in the world.
I think there's a lot of division. And I think what we have to do is bring this country together. Because I think in the 21st century, in the year 2014, I think we face the decision of going in one or two directions. I think we can be an American renaissance. I think we can be a country that has a strong economic recovery, an agile defense force for the world. I think that develops energy independence, that develops the skills we need for our children in the future. I think we have the potential to be that kind of America for the future. But I also think we could be an American decline if we allow the kind of crisis-by-crisis dysfunction that we see in Washington to prevail. So we've got a fundamental decision to make in this country as to what direction do we want to take for the future.
Live from New York City, you're watching Bloomberg Television.
You are watching
Bloomberg Television.
Bloomberg Television.
Did you get that?
Ours was the first modern airliner, revolutionary by every standard. And that became our passion, to always build something better. Airplanes that fly cleaner and farther on less fuel, that redefine comfort and connect the world like never before. After all, you can't turn dreams into airplanes unless your passion for innovation is nonstop.
Occur when both share a passion for improving, for growing in harmony. Speak from the heart and respect the other. Feeling of being comfortable, of being open, that creates the true partnership, which ensures the greatest success. Together, invest in remarkable Indonesia.
There are challenges we didn't have in the past. China, with the size of its economy, will exceed the gross size of the American economy sometime soon. You've got Russia, which is of a different attitude, it seems, today than it might have been when there was talk of détente, of a talk of cooperation or resetting and all of that. The president made a decision to pivot to China. Did you agree with that decision?
Yeah, we recommended that we would do a rebalance to Asia-Pacific.
Because that's the future?
Because that is the future in terms of countries that are developing their economies, an area where there is a tremendous potential for trade, for prosperity. Where I think, our interests are in developing a strong security presence in the Pacific, to work with those countries to make sure that
you were head of CIA and you still, talk to people who know things. What do you make of this new president of China, Xi Jinping? He seems to be different, and he seems to be on a mission for China.
Yeah.
In part economic, but also in part in playing a role in the region for sure.
No, there's no question in my mind. I really found him to be a very interesting individual because, normally when I used to meet with the Chinese, they used to operate off of talking points.
Yeah.
And their talking points always included Taiwan, the Uyghurs, this group that, just keeps disrupting China. They're concerned about other issues. So you couldn't get through anything else but the talking points. She basically engaged in a conversation in which, he said, why are you rebalancing to the Pacific and doing that? And I said, because what we're interested in, we're a Pacific power, you're a Pacific power. I think you want peace and prosperity in this region. We face some common threats from North Korea and from other areas. We can work together with the countries in Southeast Asia to really produce tremendous prosperity for the future. And he agreed with that. But, he was willing to ask the right questions. He was willing to engage in it. I talked about cyber world and the concern about cyber attacks. And he said we ought to create a dialogue to talk through those issues. So I see him as somebody who really wants to obviously strengthen China, but who really does also want to engage with the United States and other countries in the world.
At the same time, they're going around the world with contracts in Africa and everywhere else. They're showing, do they have more of a long-term strategy than we do?
China is interested in doing what's important for China. I think if you read Henry Kissinger, he basically says this is about China. This is about their kingdom. And that's what they focus on.
Isn't that what you expect from a leadership, isn't it?
Well, but it's important to understand where they're coming from. And I think that's the focus they have. They're looking at ways to improve their economy, to develop the resources they need in their economy for the future. And I think you have to understand that that's where they're headed. Now, does that mean that we shouldn't engage with them and, in fact, check them when they overstep the bounds? I think we have to. For example, their claim to territorial claims in the South China Sea. The fact that they're trying to assert themselves in violation of international rules, I think we've got to say to them that's wrong and that we've got to find better ways to try to deal with that. But I think it is important to have communication with China for the future.
And Russia in Ukraine?
I think Russia, the danger we're facing now is what I would call almost a renewal of the Cold War
mentality. And do you think it's in part because they saw the president as weak?
I think that Putin, everybody who's dealt with Putin, he is what he is in that his goal is to try to make very certain that Russia again extends its influence over the former countries that were part of the Soviet Union. That's his goal, to divide East from West and to make that assertion. And I think what he did in the Ukraine is in part a reflection of his read that perhaps the United States would not take action.
And so how does the United States convince him otherwise?
I think you have to make very clear to him.
How do you do that?
Well, it's not just sanctions. I think sanctions are important, but it's not just sanctions. I think, frankly, we ought to be providing aid to the Ukrainians. I think we ought to provide military aid to the Ukrainians to make very clear to them.
By sending them tanks,
military assistance. I think they need military assistance.
But that's tanks and things like that.
Yeah. And we know, look, Russia is strong, but we need to make Russia understand that they're going to have to pay a price. Thirdly, I think it's very important for us to strengthen NATO and strengthen the NATO presence in the countries adjoining Russia. Fourthly, frankly, I would resurrect the whole issue of missile defense. We had been engaged in negotiations with them on missile defense. But if they're going to behave the way they are now in charging into the Ukraine, I think we have to resurrect the prospect that we're going to again start talking to countries about missile defense. And lastly, I think we've got to develop over the long term another source of energy for those countries in Europe and in the former Soviet Union
that are
so dependent
on
energy. We are not really selling our energy abroad as fast as we should.
Because we will be the largest energy supplier in the world.
That's right, and we should make use of that in order to try to give these countries another source of energy.
Iran, do you think there'll be a deal?
I'd like hope and pray that there'll be a deal.
I know. We all would. What does your analysis tell you? I mean, you talk.
I think, Iran.
You know how far apart they are?
Yeah, I think they are.
You know what they're demanding?
Yeah, I do. And I've always had concerns about Iran and their intentions around the world because, very frankly, I've seen the Quds Force, which is their secret police operation.
Would you like to have a conversation with General Soleimani?
Yeah, I mean, I'd love to have the opportunity to talk with him because they have, in essence, spread terrorism through five continents trying to produce instability. So they're a dangerous customer to deal with. And I think we have to understand that there is no way that we should allow them to develop their nuclear capability and certainly to not develop
a
weapon.
What does that mean?
I mean, the president took the right step in getting the international community to apply sanctions against Iran. I think these are very tough sanctions, and I think they ultimately helped bring them to the table. But I think it's very important now that we're at the table to make very clear that we are not going to allow them to have the ability to develop enriched fuel.
At what point, if you were Secretary of Defense, if you were CIA Director, would you say to the President, we have to strike their nuclear facilities now? When would you advise the President do that?
We had a lot of that debate in the time that I was there as CIA Director and then as Secretary of Defense. And I think it was very clear to me that if the Iranians made the decision that they were going to produce a nuclear weapon, and we had the intelligence to back that up, that we would not allow that to happen, even if that meant military action.
Even that meant taking it out.
That's right.
Strike against them.
That's right.
But that suggests they have not made that decision.
That's correct.
So as long as they're negotiating, you assume they haven't made that decision.
I think at least the intelligence analysis at the time that when I left being Secretary of Defense was that they had not made that decision at that point in time.
At what point do you think Israel would say, we can't wait for the United States, we think they've already made that decision?
Well, when I was Secretary of Defense, they actually got to the point where we thought they had made the decision that they were not going to, they don't have, that we were, they were, they really felt that it was important to strike Iran now and strike their nuclear capability because I think they were concerned about a so-called fast track in which when they made the decision,
they could be there instantly.
They could produce it within a short period of time. And they just did not feel that that they wanted to give them that ability. We engaged in long conversations with them. I think we indicated, look, you can give them a black eye, but you can't take out, their capability.
You need us to
do
that.
The way we can. And recognizing that, I think they made the decision, believing that we would act. If they, in fact, made the decision to develop a nuclear weapon, I think they were willing to give us that room. Whether they're willing to do that now, I don't know.
So you've written this book, Worthy Fights. Was it hard work?
I mean, it's work because you want to be able to make sure it's accurate and that you've got, the stuff particularly. Look, the stuff from my background, the stuff from the time I was in Congress and civil rights, et cetera. I mean, those are things that, I had a pretty good feel for. But when you're dealing with the CIA stuff and when you're dealing with the defense stuff, you want to make very sure that that's as accurate as possible. And we had to actually make sure that CIA and the Defense Department signed off on that, and they did.
At the same time, the president didn't sign off on it.
Although we did send him a copy of it.
I'm sure you did. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Pleasure. Good to see you.
Nice to see you, Charles.
And the book is called Worthy Fights, Leon Panetta with Jim Newton. Thank you for joining us. See you next time.
Kidding me? Everybody's on woo woo.
Woo woo.
Lock and load, people.
We're going all in on woo woo.
Mark, comp us up a profile page.
Susie, write us some posts.
I want sponsored woos. I want targeted woos.
We need an ethnically ambiguous woo woo mascot.
Dude, are you still on woo woo?
Nah, man. My mom's on woo woo.
We all think about life insurance, but when we start worrying about tomorrow, we miss out on the things that matter today. At AXA, we offer advice and help you break down your insurance goals into small, manageable steps. Because when you plan for tomorrow, it helps you live for today. Can we help you take a small step? For advice, retirement, and life insurance, connect with AXA.
How do you start your day so you make better investment decisions?
You watch Bloomberg Surveillance to find out what the markets are doing. And you talk to smart people. Bloomberg Surveillance, weekdays at 6 a.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Television.
We're at a place in our lives where we need investment income. That's why we invest in tax-free municipal bonds.
We love the income they provide us, income that's federally tax-free. And at this point in our lives, tax-free income is exactly what we need.
Tax-free municipal bonds can serve as the cornerstone for a conservative portfolio. They offer income that's tax-free. Henning and Walsh is a leading expert in tax-free municipal bonds committed to finding you the best bonds to meet your investment goals. We'll even send you our informative bond guide absolutely free if you call right now. 1-800-895-7895. If you have at least $10,000 to invest, consider municipal bonds. They provide income that's federally tax-free. Take charge of your investments today. Call now to receive your free copy of our informative bond guide. It's free, so call now. 1-800-895-7895. That's 1-800-895-7895.
Ours was the first modern airliner, revolutionary by every standard. And that became our passion, to always build something better. Airplanes that fly cleaner and farther on less fuel, that redefine comfort and connect the world like never before. After all, you can't turn dreams into airplanes unless your passion for innovation is nonstop.
Partnerships occur when both share a passion for improving, for growing in harmony. Speak from the heart and respect the other. Feeling of being comfortable, of being open, that creates the true partnership. which ensures the greatest success. Together, invest in remarkable Indonesia.
I'm Mark Halperin.
And I'm John Heilman. And with all due respect to the Washington Nationals, I am just going to love seeing Al Hunt in a San Francisco Giants cap. Namaste, sports fans. In today's lineup, a series of sizzling slug lines. Steve Scalise gives us whiplash, some split-screen political ads, and the always hilarious Sarah Silverman talks about her...
Hold on there. But first, we go to South Dakota. You'll go for Mount Rushmore in Bear Country, USA, but you're going to stay now for the four-way Senate free-for-all. Things got interesting this afternoon, and it's more confusing than the leftovers on HBO, which is why John and I are going to explain to you this breaking news, which we broke on BloombergPolitics.com. Democrats think they can hold the Senate seat there. Tim Johnson is retiring. It's a seat Republicans have been counting on. The news today, Democrats are going to spend $1 million there, some in the field, but mostly on television, mostly on negative ads, to try to get hold this seat, which would absolutely revolutionize how we think about the Senate battlegrounds. Tell us why.
Well, this has been one of these seats that Republicans have had considered safe and had in their back pocket. They need to gain
one of the six
they needed, right? So here is the situation in South Dakota. You have Mike Rounds, a former governor. He's the Republican candidate, an establishment candidate, has been in the lead, not able to hugely, but in the lead for quite a while. Rick Weiland is the Democrat. Larry Pressler, the former Republican senator from South Dakota, but who is kind of a liberal Republican senator, has endorsed President Obama previously. He's been running as an independent. And there's Gordon Howie, who is an independent also. He's not like Larry Pressler, though. He's kind of a libertarian. Pretty much this race has been with Rounds in the lead in the kind of high 30s and the others kind of scrapping around, Howie down in the single digits. But all of a sudden, Pressler is on the rise and Rounds is dropping. And right. That has opened the door suddenly to this news that we've reported today.
Right. So what Democrats are saying, you know, the old Woody Hayes thing, when you pass the football, three things can happen, two of them bad.
Right.
Right. In this case, Democrats feel like if Whelan wins or if Pressler wins, Whelan will, of course, caucus with the Democrats, but Pressler might. That would give them the ability to hold the seat. Republicans are saying on the record, no problem here, this is a Republican state. The fact is, it currently has a Democratic senator. Not that long ago, it had two Democratic senators. And Mike Rounds does not do negative ads. He doesn't even do contrast ads. $1 million in 3 weeks. Democrats could never have won this seat with a long-term plan. But they think 3 weeks, lightning strike, $1 million. They've got a chance to hold the seat either with Whelan or with Pressler. That would change the battlefield. And again, Rounds has got a bit of a cap. We both were talking about the math with four people in the race, not sure what Howie's ceiling is, but either Whelan or Pressler could end up winning this with the low to mid-30s.
Right. Whelan has been stuck in that kind of high 20s. He's not moved at all. All the movement is with Pressler and Rounds. And if Pressler kind of rising up, there's a bunch of voters in Montana or in South Dakota who don't think that they want to vote for a Democrat, but are uncomfortable with Rounds. You know, the theory is that they could be moved to Pressler if they can make Rounds seem more conservative than he is. The wild card over here, he's now off the board, but his Howie, that guy, he's been everywhere between 1% and 8-9% in the polls. If he's up at 7 or 8%, you could win this race with 33%.
This is a very smart move for the Democrats. They got the $1 million to spend. It could change the whole thing.
Yeah. All right. Now we present a tale of two ads. In New Hampshire, Scott Brown, like a lot of Republican candidates in tight Senate races, is being attacked on women's rights. In North Carolina, Kay Hagan, like a lot of Democrats, is being attacked for being weak on ISIL. Today, each candidate released a defensive ad that was a classic version of the form. So classic that if you stripped out the particular issues being addressed, they would be identical, all the way down to the adagio piano in the background. So here, side by side, are Scott Brown on women's rights and Kay Hagan on foreign policy.
You may have seen that Senator Shaheen is running an ad calling into question my support for women's health care. I want you to know the facts.
I'm Kay Hagan. Speaker Tillis should be ashamed for running an ad that says I would let our soldiers die in vain. That is outrageous.
I'm pro-choice. I support continued funding for Planned Parenthood, and I believe women should have access to contraception.
On destroying ISIS, I've been clear and decisive, supporting airstrikes and aggressive tactics to eradicate them.
After 6 years of voting with President Obama, Senator Shaheen has resorted to a smear campaign to distract voters from her record. Senator Shaheen knows better, and the people of New Hampshire deserve better. I'm Scott Brown, and I approve this message.
I approve this message because I'll stand up to anyone when it comes to protecting our military. And Speaker Tillis knows that.
Okay, it's fair to say.
I love the piano music is identical.
I know, it's fantastic. It might be actually the same song. It's fair to say that those two folks do not have a lot in common on a lot of things. But on this issue, on the dealing with the attacks that they're facing, they have fallen back to a standard playbook. It's a playbook that's not a Republican playbook or a Democratic playbook. It's a political consultant's playbook. Talk about that.
You start by saying, how dare my opponent do this, but not in an angry way, right? Kind of a disappointed way. Right. Then the long defense. I mean, these are defensive ads because the opposition is going after him on these issues. Then the long defense and the piano music meant, again, to soften it up. And then at the end, the more indignation of the opponent saying they know better. I mean, both these candidates wouldn't be doing it if they thought these issues were harmless. Karl Rove and other smart strategists say all the time, you got to respond. You can't just be attacked. But both of them, I think, do a nice job of pushing back, talking about their positive agenda in a way. And we're going to see a lot more of these because people like in our business like say, oh, there are more negative ads this cycle than there have ever been. No, they're always almost pretty much all negative ads. But these are pretty well-produced pushbacks. And both of them, I think, pretty good on camera. Scott Brown is known to be. That's about as well as I've seen Kay Hagan perform on camera in an ad or any other content.
They're both fine, but there is an incredible quality throughout them of kind of, you know, the, as you said, the soft tone of righteous indignation. So it's like, Mark, you've impugned my mother. You've impugned my family. But, you know, I'm outraged. And I'm disgusted. But I'm going to kind of laugh.
You know better. You know better, John.
You know better than that. My goodness. It's a really quite funny to watch them do this. I think actually both those ads are good, though, and what they need to do.
Yeah. All right. Yesterday, we made a bet right here with Josh Earnest, the White House press secretary, that President Obama would never again utter the phrase that his policies are on the ballot in the midterms. Of course, it doesn't really matter what Josh said because Republicans are going to say it anyway. So last night we took a sampling. There were some big Senate debates. Listen to these Senate candidates talk about President Obama trying to inject him into the race. Cory Gardner in Colorado, Tom Tillis in North Carolina, and Ed Gillespie in Virginia, all invoking Barack Obama.
On the ballot in just a few weeks will be the president's policies. Mark Udall has voted for the president's policies 99% of the time, and that's what we're going to be voting on.
Senator Hagan went to Raleigh, or went to Washington, left Raleigh, turned her back on it, went to Washington, and has voted with the president 96% of the time.
The Obama-Warner policies. As a result of the Obama-Warner policies, under the Obama-Warner policies...
So we've got an interview going up on BloombergPolitics.com with Jonathan Martin of the New York Times, who wrote a piece this morning basically saying the president's not welcome very many places. Republicans, though, welcome him rhetorically in all these debates. This seems to be their main line of attack and likely will be, right, all the way through?
Yeah, throughout. I mean, look, on the specific policies, we've talked about this a bunch. So on his last specific policies, voters are with the Democrats. But on President Obama personally, there's a lot of disillusionment. I think that one of the things that Jonathan and we discussed just now is it's a little weird to me that so much focuses on travel, right? Because the president, if he goes the other day to Evanston, Illinois, you know, that becomes a national story immediately. As soon as he says something about how his policies are on the ballot, it gets picked up by everyone everywhere. It goes on the air.
I hear Jonathan said that, and you're saying it now. The fact is, yes, everything he says gets covered. But if he went into North Carolina, it would be wall-to-wall coverage, and it would dominate. And then, of course, you'd have the question of, does Kay Hagan appear with him? If he goes to Colorado, does Udall appear with him?
Well, that's the biggest problem, because if they don't, it's a snub,
correct.
And then the snub becomes
correct.
A story.
So that's the reason why travel is a problem. And, you know, you and I have talked about it and wrote about Obama in 2006 when he was a senator.
Right. He could go anywhere.
Not only could he go anywhere.
They wanted him.
In rural Missouri, in rural Florida.
Sure.
Now he can't even go the three states we showed. He won Virginia twice. He won Colorado twice. North Carolina once.
Can't go to Iowa.
Can't go to any of these places. And the question is begged, and, you know, Josh and other White House officials and Obama people dodge it. Where will he go? The clock is ticking. So far, he has not gone and appeared with a single candidate. Maybe he won't.
He's going to spend a lot of time where he was yesterday here in New York fundraising. He's going to spend a lot of time in California fundraising. You can imagine him going to Wisconsin, for instance, and doing some campaigning for the governor there, but some House races campaign, but not in any
not
of these contested
of
Senate
places.
Races. No doubt about that.
All right. We're moving on now to a 2016 question where one of the big questions for the Republican Party is how do conservatives feel about Jeb Bush, particularly his positions on Common Core and immigration? Those are big hot buttons for a lot of people on the right. Earlier today in this very studio, we put that question to Steve Scalise. He's the Republican congressman from Louisiana and the new House Republican whip. What is a whip, I hear you ask? Yeah. Basically, it's Kevin Spacey's character in House of Cards, just without all the homicide and none of the threesomes. So here's what Congressman Scalise had to say when we asked about Jeb Bush's positions on Common Core and immigration and whether he would support him.
No matter what candidate you have, you're going to have disagreements with them. Ronald Reagan used to say, if you're with me over 80% of the time, you're a friend and an ally. And whenever we get a nominee, I haven't picked anybody. I'm encouraging good people to run right now.
Okay.
You don't think either one of those things is disqualifying for Jeb Bush?
Look, Jeb Bush isn't the only person looking at this race. There are a lot of good people looking at this race. I want to see a very healthy field.
It's all good with you. It's all good with you if we put it on the internet. Congressman Scalise, all good with Jeb Bush's positions on Common Cause and immigration. Is that all right?
I surely don't agree with all of his positions. But if you look at where we are right now as a party, I think we're in a really good spot. I think we're going to have a very...
So he didn't endorse him. But if you're Jeb Bush or one of his advisors, what's the temperature you take on the conservative movement's view about Bush on those issues, which are hot buttons, as I said, for a lot of Republicans?
Well, it would have been a little strange, I think, for Congressman Scalise, given how where he is relatively new to the leadership position, to come out and just stay out of position where he was in opposition to a candidate who might very well be his party's nominee if he decides to run. At the same time, he could have pushed a little harder on those things and made been more vocal about the notion that those really trouble me.
Yeah.
Those are really problematic for me, and that would be hard for Jeb Bush to get there with those things. He didn't do any of that. There was no throat clearing. No chest pounding.
I thought it was pretty good for Jeb Bush in the scheme of things.
It could have been a lot worse.
Yep.
All right.
Our full interview with Congressman Scalise, in which we also talk about his style, his turnoffs and turn-ons, and the Hispanic vote, can be found right now on BloombergPolitics.com.
Very intriguing.
Yes.
All right. Sarah Silverman is out with a new 3-minute web video in which she decides to get a sex change operation, the joke being that if women become men, they'll make more money. Now, obviously, because it's Sarah Silverman, it's not exactly safe for work. Now, there's nothing in this video that makes us remotely uncomfortable, but just to be safe, we edited out all the language that could be inappropriate for a PG-rated cable show. Here's what's left.
Oh, hi. Women will be cheated out of $11,000 every year. Okay, together donate National Women's Law Center.
That's about a 4-minute video that she's done, edited down.
We salvaged what we could. Body.
It's very body. The big punchline in this thing, she's talking here about equal pay for equal work. There's a calculation that says that over a lifetime, on average, that women lose $500,000 relative to men, and she refers to that in the early part of the video as a $500,000 tax on her vagina, which in context is quite amusing.
Yeah. The whole thing, you can see the whole thing on our website.
You can.
If you'd like to watch it for yourself.
She does these things. They're very popular. They go viral.
Yeah. All right. Move.
Up next, we've got more baseball and more politics. But first, we're going to quiz ABC News' Martha Raddatz on foreign policy. And I have a feeling that she's going to do pretty well.
Yes, she will do very, very well.
Bloomberg's With All Due Respect is brought to you by Koch Industries. Learn more at KochCareers.com.
Koch Industries started in the heartland, and we've expanded to nearly every state. Today, that's more than 60,000 American jobs. You may not always see our name on the products you use, but we help make better food, clothing, shelter, technologies, and other necessities. Here, we build on each other's ideas to create more opportunities for people everywhere. Together, we are Koch.
Try the new Bloomberg Business Week Plus app for Samsung phone and tablet and get your first year of Bloomberg Business Week free. You'll get deeper intelligence on global business, innovative companies, technology trends, and exclusive behind-the-scenes videos and interviews. Start your free Bloomberg Business Week Plus subscription on your Samsung device today.
The challenges that industry or enterprise faces the most is the consumerization of IT. Companies are having to increasingly be aware of their employee base, consuming of mobile technology and capability, and bringing that into the business and trying to leverage it in their daily work. Security is even more important in the consumerization of IT. Samsung has addressed this by bringing in a security framework to help the enterprise actually get the balance of both. Samsung's doing a lot to help our businesses meet those changes and those challenges. I believe we're the right solution for them. Samsung is committed to a holistic approach in meeting the needs of our enterprise customers in the areas of security, software, solutions, and support.
Realize the full potential of mobility. Find out more at Bloomberg.com/ad/mobile-next.
Martha Raddatz of ABC News has interviewed some of the most powerful people in the world and been to more countries than Carmen Sandiego. On Sunday, we'll be watching her exclusive interview with General Martin Dempsey, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, on ABC's This Week. Martha, thanks for joining us.
It's great to be with you.
Martha, in that interview with General Dempsey, you report that Kobani, the key Syrian town on the border of Turkey, is likely to fall to ISIS control. Can you talk about what the significance of that town is in that location?
Well, the significance is if Kobani falls, and there are thousands and thousands of people in Kobani, it's right there on the border with Turkey. You will basically lose all of northern Syria to ISIS. And you've also got Turkey not doing much about it. They're basically, you can see over the border, reports are that you can see the bombing over the border, you can see what's going on, but those tanks, those Turkish tanks, are not moving. They're just sitting there. They'd obviously do something if ISIS started moving over the border, but even General Dempsey said to me, ISIS is not stupid enough to do that. So basically, you've just got all these towns falling in that northern border area with Turkey. You've got refugees flooding over the border. General Dempsey did say to me that he was not sure about what would happen if they really did overrun the town. There were terrible, terrible reports of slaughter coming out of there. One intelligence officer from the area saying that he believes there would be slaughter within 24 to 36 hours of 5,000 people. General Dempsey said he wasn't sure of that. He thought there might not even be 5,000 people left in that town. Also said it's really hard to target now. It's really hard. I know they've done a couple, I think, in the last 24 hours, some airstrikes there. But when I talked to General Dempsey, he said they're having an awfully hard time just finding targets in that area because what ISIS has done is really adapted. They blend into the population more. They don't have really an infrastructure like a regular army. We've bombed out the training camps already, so I think it's harder and harder to find these targets.
Martha, is the Pentagon comfortable with the mission that the Commander-in-Chief has given them?
Well, I think they're certainly comfortable with the air campaign. I think they feel they have good control of that. I was out on an aircraft carrier a couple of weeks ago in the Persian Gulf, and boy, those missions were nonstop. But one of the things I did notice is a lot of those planes, a lot of those fighter jets are coming back with their bombs still attached, going again to General Dempsey's comments about they just don't have the targets. Do they wish they had ground controllers, those guys on the ground who can say, this is where you should hit. I don't think we'll have collateral damage here. I can see the enemy from here. Yeah, I think a lot of people wish they could do that, but they also know the political realities that they don't want boots on the ground. And they'll tell you that they can do it in other ways. But really, to have ground controllers there would really improve the ability to find more targets and to more accurately target from those airplanes.
Martha, yesterday the State Department spokeswoman Jen Psaki was asked if she could name one tangible area in which, since the bombing had begun, whether we could show that we'd made appreciable progress on this mission against ISIS, and she had a hard time doing that, at least in the moment, sort of stumbled around a little bit. On the basis of your reporting, can you name an area where tangible progress is reportable?
Well, I think when you say tangible progress, I think you can say, yes, things have been disrupted. But I think you have to look at it a couple of ways. I think you can say, yes, they've disrupted the enemy. They might have disrupted some plans. They might have pushed ISIS, ISIL back from areas from Baghdad. I mean, I was over there in June, and believe me, they were nervous that Baghdad might fall, that it might be overrun. So right now, they're not as nervous about that, although I do think they're getting closer to that area. But when you look at it two ways, it's okay, so they've disrupted that, but ISIS has clearly moved to other areas. So then you have to move troops to other areas. Then you have to move the Arabs to other areas. They haven't taken back any of those big cities. They haven't taken back Fallujah. I mean, Fallujah fell last January. It's been almost a year since Fallujah fell.
Martha, just about a minute we have left. Turkey is in the headlines. And how is it, how do you explain to Americans how a NATO ally needs to be cajoled to help protect its own border by the United States?
Boy, I can't explain that one, and I know that is a huge, huge frustration. I can tell with General Dempsey yesterday that is a huge frustration, that they're not doing anything. They are not, I mean, they're just not worried about ISIS coming in and getting them, I guess. And until that happens, they're really not going to do anything. They're pushing the Turks in any way they can to try to do something, to try to be more involved, but it just hasn't happened.
But what kind of arguments, quickly, what kind of arguments is the U.S. government making with the Turkish government?
Well, I think they're making the argument that you've got to protect those borders. You've got to let us, you've got to help us in this fight. You've got to go in and not worry so much about Assad, but worry about the immediate threat. The same kind of discussions the U.S. government had. What's more serious right now, the threat from leaving Assad in, or the threat to the West and to the United States? And that's the decision the U.S. has made. It's not the decision the Turks have made.
Martha Raddatz, ABC News. Thanks very much. We appreciate it. Martha's exclusive interview, as we say, can be seen this Sunday on This Week. Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Dempsey. Martha Raddatz, the ABC News Chief Global Affairs Correspondent. Martha, thanks.
Coming up, the biggest loser, Al Hunt, our very own Al Hunt, wallowing in misery over the fate of his Nationals and the bet he lost to me.
Bloomberg's With All Due Respect is brought to you by BP. Proud to be America's largest energy investor.
Folks think about what they get from Alaska. They think salmon and energy. But the energy BP produces up here creates something else as well. Jobs all over America. Engineering and innovation jobs. Advanced safety systems and technology. Shipping and manufacturing. Across the United States, BP supports more than 250,000 jobs. When we set up operation in one part of the country, people in other parts go to work. That's not a coincidence. It's one more part of our commitment to America.
Koch Industries started in the heartland, and we've expanded to nearly every state. Today, that's more than 60,000 American jobs. You may not always see our name on the products you use, but we help make better food, clothing, shelter, technologies, and other necessities. Here, we build on each other's ideas to create more opportunities for people everywhere. Together, we are Coke.
Introducing the new and improved Bloomberg app for your iPhone and iPad. Financial markets change even when you're away from your desk. Bloomberg gives you a snapshot of what's moving, plus breaking news, video, and sophisticated portfolio management tools. Download the free Bloomberg application and stay ahead wherever you are. Also available on Android, BlackBerry, and Windows Phone.
Gunderman Group.
Gunderman Group is growing.
Getting in a groove.
Growth is gratifying.
Goal is to grow.
Gotta get greater growth.
I just talked to UPS. They've got expert advice, special discounts, new technologies, like smart pickups.
They'll only show up when you print a label, and it's automatic. We save time and money.
Time?
Money?
Time and money.
Awesome.
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 Awesome. Awesome.
I love logistics.
And now for something completely excellent. Joining us now from Washington, Al Hunt, a man who is as wise as he is kind and is about to suffer a humiliation at the hands of John Heilman. Al, thanks for joining us. So you were up last night watching the game. I just want to know, as you anticipated the national season, the playoffs, did you ever imagine they'd be eliminated on a wild pitch?
No, I didn't, but I also didn't imagine that the Angels with the best record in baseball would be swept. I didn't imagine that Clayton Kershaw would blow two games. Yeah. The baseball gods do strange things in October, and they sure punished us last night.
Al, before I get to my question for you about baseball, I'm going to have to now collect on my bet. Our bet. I was all prepared to wear a Washington Nationals sweatshirt for a week on this show had you guys won, but instead I get the pleasure of watching you now put on a San Francisco Giants cap on national TV. Oh, there you go, baby.
There it is.
Now, you know you have to wear that through to Christmas, Al. Right? You can't.
And yeah, John, I cheated because I have my Washington Nationals tie on.
I know. You're trying, you don't, even at the risk of clashing, you're still going to hedge your bets on that. Tell me about who you got now in the league championship series in both of them.
Because, first of all, I think they're great matchups. The Cardinals and Giants don't have the talent of the Dodgers or Nationals, but they play better baseball. They're smart. They have got great starting pitchers. They got great catchers. I think it's just a great series. And I think the Orioles and Royals, they're both two underdogs. If I had to pick, I'd pick the Cardinals and Orioles.
All right, Al, we'll talk to you about our lead story, the story we broke on BloombergPolitics.com about this South Dakota Senate race. Are Democrats wise to spend $1 million there? You think they have a chance to hold the seat?
I think there's more intrigue in South Dakota than an episode of Homeland, Mark. I really do. It's a three-way race. It's a pocket, side pocket shot. I heard from Larry Pressler today, the used-to-be Republican senator, now running as an independent, voted for Obama. He's got a shot in this race. And Harry Reid, the majority leader who wants to keep his majority, hates Rick Wyland, the Democratic candidate, and the feelings are mutual. So I think the Democrats are really going to watch this very carefully in the next couple of weeks. I don't think both Wyland and Pressler can be at 30-32%. One of them has to surge in order to beat Mike Rounds, the heavily favored Republican who I gather is running a terrible campaign.
What do you think the low number is on that, Al, for what you're going to need to win that race? With that, there are actually four candidates, as you know. So what do you think you
right,
can get?
What's conservative.
What's the minimum number you could get through with?
I would guess it would be 37 or 38, and that's assuming the conservative gets, you know, 4 or 5%. But I think at some point somebody has to be the alternative to Rounds. If that doesn't occur, then he can probably squeak through. If that does occur, I think he's in trouble, from what I hear.
And now, really,
from what Mark reported today.
Really quick, is President Obama more radioactive than a typical incumbent in his 6th year, or this is par for the course?
Well, it's pretty par for the course, but he compounds it sometimes with some statements that don't help Democrats. The same ads that we're running against Obama now, Mark Warner voted with him 98% of the time, Kay Hagan 97. Those same ads were run in 2006. Rick Santorum voted with George W. Bush 98% of the times. They're all kind of bogus, but it shows what president's popularity is in the 6th year, and this guy is in bad shape, as you noted earlier.
When the president came out last week and said that his policies were on the ballot, most Democratic candidates around the country were upset. Why did he do that? What explanation do you have? He shouldn't have.
You know, if he had said, because frankly, they don't think very carefully sometimes over there. And for this guy who's so eloquent, he sometimes can be incredibly reckless with his rhetoric. If he had said minimum wage is on the ballot, pay equity is on the ballot, I think Democrats would have been fine.
Right. Of course.
But instead, he said my issues are on the ballot.
Al Hunt of Bloomberg View and the San Francisco Giants, thank you very much for joining us. And we'll be right back.
Bye, Al.
Bloomberg's With All Due Respect is brought to you by Mercedes-Benz, engineering some of the most advanced vehicles on the road today.
Automotive innovation starts right here with a control pad that can read your handwriting, a widescreen multimedia center, and a head-up display for enhanced driver focus, all inside a newly redesigned cabin of unrivaled style and comfort. The all-new C-Class. At the very touch point of performance and innovation.
Breitling, instruments for professionals.
Only Bloomberg Television has the interviews you want to hear.
One of the fascinating things about Twitter is that once you get it, it becomes indispensable to you.
My eyes were all created equal.
Online, on your tablet, and on your phone. Bloomberg Television, wherever you are.
Coke Industries started in the heartland, and we've expanded to nearly every state. Today, that's more than 60,000 American jobs. You may not always see our name on the products you use, but we help make better food, clothing, shelter, technologies, and other necessities. Here, we build on each other's ideas to create more opportunities for people everywhere. Together, we are Coke.
We are only on the air a half hour a day, but we are live 24-7 on BloombergPolitics.com. Get on that website and check out Mark's reporting on the South Dakota Senate race.
But right now, you can stay tuned for Bloomberg's Taking Stock, which is on next. See you tomorrow.
Partner.
partnerships occur when both share a passion for improving, for growing in harmony. Speak from the heart and respect the other. Feeling of being comfortable, of being open, that creates the true partnership, which ensures the